It is Saturday, January 9th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, the geek news. In the second half, your questions and comments about technology.
We're through with being cool.
That doesn't count.
We're through with being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, Slacker, and Political Junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Al Luckow, new media architect. Morning.
Hi, everybody.
And we also, over the phone, have Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy. Hey, Ben.
Hey there.
Wow, that is really
barely
quiet.
Barely hear you.
He is so quiet.
Yeah, I'll adjust some settings.
Whoa, hello.
Is this better?
That's a lot better.
Hello, hello.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks.
Why do you sound so funny?
Do I sound really funny?
No.
I just got a new phone, and I'm calling because my internet is very bad. I'm calling and then going through a Bluetooth headset through my computer to my phone through the airwaves to KUSP.
Okay, I get that. What's the phone?
It is the Google Nexus One, actually.
Wow.
It's the new Google phone that just released, which is, oh, it's so fantastic, I have to say. Granted, all of my opinions might be a little bit inflated because I have been smartphone-less for the past, well, ever. And so I've been seeing all these people doing these little tricks on these phones, but I've never actually had one for myself. So anyway, I feel like I've discovered a whole new world. It's fantastic.
It's a whole new world, huh?
It's all googly and everything.
All you iPhone people out there, yeah.
It's a Google world.
You iPhone people? Yeah. What are you trying to say? You're saying we're using
this is a Google world.
Man, your phone, you're not making a good argument for Google phone.
Yeah.
I can't hear you. But we'll keep moving on.
Latent connection.
So you're saying the iPhone's kind of old school, kind of like Betamax and other tape phones.
Well, I wasn't saying that. I was just saying that everyone has had iPhones for forever and they've been doing fancy tricks and I've never quite understood it. And now I understand the beauty and joy of having a smartphone.
Great. Well, welcome to us all.
You have been assimilated.
Al, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
So tell me what's going on with the videotape.
Well, if you are a lover of Canon video cameras and you've used them in the past and you want to stay with them, you will no longer be using videotape.
Why?
They have officially decided we are no longer going to support any kind of videotape. We're not going to do disk drive cameras. All of our cameras are going to have flash memory. So there's no longer going to be any Canon video cameras that use tape. Tape is going to be like the kind of thing that we all remember, like records, and our kids are like, "What's this, Dad? Put that down." You know, it's going to be, what is all this tape? You know, that's what's happening now. Canon's the first one to do it. They have one camera that will have tape, but it's like some high-end HD thing,
right.
Like, you know, what nobody has.
But just flash, no hard drives either?
No hard drive ones either.
Do you think that the mini DV tape is going the way of the dodo?
Well, you know, I hope not because...
Really?
Oops. Did that? Really, what's... you know, I have a lot of mini DVs, and I like it. I have an HD cam, you know, Sony, but... and I like the mini DV tapes. They hold a lot of data. They're archivable. They're not real expensive. If you have flash drives or whatever, and you're saving video, you got to put that video somewhere.
Yeah,
you can't just like leave it on your camera. You got to move it to your computer. And everybody knows computers or video is very big.
Yeah.
So you got all this data, and you got to stick it somewhere, and you want to throw it away. But then again, it's just, you know, this birthday party, and it was kind of neat, but you really don't care. You'll probably never watch it, but you just don't want to throw it away. So you put it on your computer using up valuable space, whereas nowadays, you could just keep your tapes, you know, keep a box of tapes, and that was fine, you know, and if ever
okay, so
you
let
want
me
to
ask
go
you
into
this.
It.
What about buying flash memory like you do tapes? What about buying, like, 64 gigabyte SD cards and just use those and then save them? Are they just too expensive still?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe that will be something that happens in the future, but I don't see how flash drives are going to be as cheap as tape.
Well, how much is tape right now? $20 for 20, something like that?
Yeah, it's like a buck or two for like an hour or 2 hours of tape. And that, I mean, So yeah, well, I don't know, you know. I mean, it's so anyway, Canon is not going to support these old-fashioned, antique, steam-powered tape cassettes.
I feel like just yesterday we were saying, you know, no more film. If you've got film cameras, get rid of them because digital cameras are going to take over and it's going to be hard to find film.
Right.
And before that was, yeah, it's really hard to find black and white film at this point.
Uh-huh.
But it looks like it just everything changes.
Yeah. I mean, I fully embrace the digital camera thing.
But I, for one, fully embrace our camera overlords.
Yeah.
Our tapeless camera overlords.
Yeah. But video, I don't know.
Well, Miles, what's going on with Galileo?
Well, I just wanted to mention, this is a quick topic. Recently, we had the 400-year anniversary, or 400th anniversary, of Galileo's observation of Jupiter's four largest moons. And this was one of the major turning points to move away from the Earth-centric model to a heliocentric model.
Mm-hmm.
Where Earth was not the center of the solar system. Also one of the points that got him into a lot of trouble. And this is what, and he was looking at Jupiter and saw these curious stars that were hovering around Jupiter, or what he thought were stars at the time, or what a lot of people did. And this was all done January 7th, 1610.
Wow. Isn't Jupiter like a baby star or something? Like it's more star-like?
It's a gas giant. Yeah. It's not large enough where gravity can induce nuclear fusion.
Mm. And that's big. I mean, I think it's big.
But there is a lot of radiation.
Too small, but...
Yeah, but I mean, the moons still get a fair amount of radiation from Jupiter because of its size.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. All right, well, thanks for the update. So, Ben, you've got some famous astronomer information?
I do. I want to talk about Apophis first, and then I have an update on the Kepler mission in my next news story. But Apophis is an asteroid that a lot of people were concerned would hit Earth in 2029 or 2036. And so back in 2004, there were headlines that said there was a 1 in 37 chance that this asteroid would collide with Earth in 2029. And so we've taken a whole bunch of measurements of its trajectory and everything, and we've pretty much ruled out that impact. But there is a possibility, very small possibility, 1 in 250,000 chance that it would pass by Earth in 2029 and then strike Earth in 2036. And again, this is very remote.
But so the basic issue is when a body gets really close to us, like it's going to get in 2029, the calculations of what then happens after it passes us is very difficult because the mass of Earth, the moon, and the complexity of that causes it to shift a little bit. So the next time it comes around the sun, it potentially could collide with us. So go on.
Yeah, exactly. That the gravity of the Earth would change its trajectory. And if it were to hit Earth, it would be very, very bad. NASA has, that it would release over 100,000 times the energy that was released in the blast over Hiroshima.
Yeah.
So really, really big deal. Russian scientists have started formulating plans to do something about this, even though there's a very, very remote chance that it will strike. We also have more data that's going to be coming in about 2013 where we can kind of better refine the probability. But one of the ideas is that if we launch a rocket that's maybe about the size of a small car,
mm-hmm.
and we put that right next to the asteroid, then the gravitational pull of the asteroid and of the rocket would attract, and they would pull each other or pull themselves together. And then if you kept the rocket hovering a certain distance away from the asteroid, then the asteroid would slowly change course. And so they calculated that they could do that with that kind of a rocket in like 75 days, just move it out of the path of the Earth. So,
75
yeah, there
are days.
There's some things being done.
75 mm-hmm. days to do?
To actually tether it for 75 days. If you put the rocket next to you,
it would take
burn
like
your birth
20 years to get a rocket up there to do that.
It could take some time.
In actual
No,
usage.
It won't take that long. Ben, Russia's planning on doing this?
Russia is thinking about doing it, and these are the first plans that I have heard. I'm sure there are other plans, but these are the first plans that I have heard out in the press.
Yeah, I've heard about it too.
To do office.
And the troublesome thing about it is that it's possible that, you know, that the eye of the needle can be Earth at some point, right? That something's going to go through that and we're going to get hit. And it's also possible that this thing's not going to do that. And by modifying it slightly, it will. Like,
you know who's good at that?
Yeah, good at that?
Bruce Willis.
Bruce Willis could do it.
Yeah, he could get up there. I've seen him do this. He can get up there, land on the asteroid, and, you know, plant explosives and stuff.
Is that because of his oil rigging experience, oil drilling experience?
He's just got experience in all sorts of things, like blowing up buildings and catching guys. Bruce Willis would be able to fix this asteroid problem for us.
If only he was Russian.
Just because I'm getting hives that people are invoking that movie Armageddon on
the
show.
See Miles slowly smoking. The top of his head is burning.
Yeah. It's Armageddon. The only thing that, the only science that Armageddon got right was that asteroids exist, and from time to time they hit the Earth. That's it. Everything else in that movie was completely wrong.
Well, I think Bruce Willis would have.
And also, of course, in the movie, the asteroid splits up into two very large chunks and everything, and that's not necessarily what would happen. Actually, one of the quotes that I found. One of the researchers, Permanov, said that, quote, there won't be any nuclear explosions. Everything will be done according to the laws of physics.
nice.
And then I thought, wait, aren't explosions according to the laws of physics, too?
But, he means that it wouldn't help at all to do that. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, this is a fun topic to...
Right.
Yeah, this is a fun topic to bring up, but like a nuclear weapon, and the reason why it's so destructive here is also because it's a big fireball, and you're heating up the air, and that's what causes a lot of the shockwave, is you have that explosive expansion of air pushing out.
Right. You've got mass to play with.
Right. And then the heats up, it goes straight up, that's the mushroom cloud, and it sucks all the air back in again. That's that suction that comes after the fact. In space, there's no air.
Right.
So there's nothing... heat up to expand.
Right.
So big, you have a big fireball going on, but there's no actual breaking apart. You make the rock molten.
All right. Well, thanks, Ben, for that story. All right. Let's go on to Al's story about Magic Jack. I actually use Magic Jack.
Really?
But not for a cell phone. But I use, Magic Jack's basically a really low cost phone over internet.
Right.
System, and it's like a little USB dongle you plug into a computer, and then you get a phone line. You can plug a normal phone into it, and it's pretty cool as long as you've got Ethernet.
Right.
As long as you've got network.
I thought about making it a crazy USB device, but it really isn't that crazy.
No, it's not.
I mean, it's a pretty good idea. Well, everybody knows CES is going on right now,
right?
Or most of the people listening to us
Consumer
know CES.
Consumer Electronics Show.
Yes, in Las Vegas. It's like the first year I haven't gone in like 10 years.
Why aren't you going?
I don't know. It's just, it's expensive and just everything in the economy. I don't know. I'm not going this year.
Okay.
Anyhow, there's one of the many things that were being announced there. There's all sorts of new things. Like there's a new Roomba vacuum cleaner. Well, there's a thing that's kind of like the Magic Jack, except it's called the Femto Jack. And this thing you plug into your cell phone and it allows you to make free mobile phone calls completely free. And you might be wondering if this is legal. Yes, it is. The Femto Jack will be using radio frequencies. But these are the same frequencies many cell providers have paid billions of dollars for exclusive licenses on. But it is completely legal. There's one catch. It'll only work with certain cell phones that have SIM card slots.
So it's a car. Its interface is a SIM card.
It won't be compatible with Verizon or Sprint, but it'll likely work with several AT&T, Singular, and T-Mobile.
It's a GSM phone then.
Yes.
But it's not a phone.
Connecting, you know, this guy figured out how to do this.
Is it using the internet protocol that is in the phone? It's not.
But that's not the internet protocol at that point.
Well, that's what the question is. What is it doing? It doesn't make any sense that it would be free unless it's, because somebody's got to receive the signal at the carrier.
Well, the thing. You know, the guy that invented this has figured out a way around it, and you know, all the carriers are scrambling to try to find a legal loophole to try to get him on this. But it's there, right. And they announced it at CES. The customers, you know, out there are going to love this thing.
Well, you'd think
it's the magic. It says in here, the Magic Jack inventor seems to have stumbled upon quite a concept, which may save consumers tons of money until someone finds a way to prevent it.
Hmm.
So it's there. It's going. It's been announced January 8th. It exists. It's called the FemtoJack. And
all right. Well, I'll have to look a little bit more into it, figure out the technology behind it, because it seems so confusing to me. Let's go ahead and go on to Miles, I think. What's up to the DNA database?
We all know that our DNA is unique. We all know that in cop shows, you check your DNA and you can say, oh, hey, this is the person. Except that there actually hasn't been any peer-reviewed study to check to see is the DNA, especially with the tests we're using, showing that we are all sufficiently unique. We'd always assumed that, oh, it would be, you know, 1 in a billion chance. So there's 6 other people on the planet that, or 5 other people on the planet that have the same DNA as you. But that's an assumption. We've never actually tested that.
Okay.
And so
it sounds like a pretty good assumption, the mathematical probabilities and such, but go on.
On the contrary, we're assuming that the DNA is that distinct.
Okay.
It may not be.
Okay.
And so many scientists have said, I want to look at this corpus of data. And who has the biggest corpus of data? That's probably going to be law enforcement.
Right.
But they've always pushed back. The reason has always been privacy.
Right.
And the like, which is curious because they've always been lobbying for things that erode privacy so they can get more information. So, but many scientists in the US and the UK are really worried about what's known as the random match probability. And so there are 41 scientists that have signed a petition demanding access to CODIS, the U.S. National DNA Database, which contains over 7 million profiles.
Wow.
So they can test the assumptions.
And can you give me can you explain what that means, the what do you call it, the idea that you could get a match from two different?
The idea is when you take a DNA sample, you are not testing that person's entire genome.
Right. You're not sequencing the entire
segment. You are looking for specific markers. And if you you don't have to just look for blood, you can look for a lot of different samples and be able to find out and for ruling someone out, it's great. If a different sequence shows up than what you have, it's absolutely ruling you out.
Right.
But people have been using it as evidence to say that, oh, we found this evidence and it matches this person, therefore it's probably this person.
Right.
That's the part that people are taking issue with.
So what they want to do basically is take a look at, 7 million or do you say 700?
There's 7 million profiles.
7 million profiles and see if any of them are the same. Or how similar.
See how many of them are the same and see how what correlations can be made from them with regard to ethnicity, with regard
to
background, geography.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that. Ben, earlier I prompted you for some information about an ancient scientist, and I was talking about Kepler. So will you please give me the Kepler story now?
Yes. Kepler was indeed an ancient scientist, and there is a mission that had been named after him. I've talked about it before on the show. Basically, it looks at light levels of stars, and it looks at dips in those levels, dips and then the rises again, and infers the existence of planets, which are actually passing in front of on the stars and blocking the light and then moving out of the path. Occlusion is what it's called. And I have some news. The Kepler mission has found 5 awesome planets. Now, we've talked about planets that the Kepler mission has talked about, but these are actually the first 5 that it's found, according to the NASA press release, which I didn't know that. I didn't realize that it was only looking at planets that we already knew about. The mission started back in May, and these findings are based on 6 weeks of data. We found 5 different planets. All of them are ridiculously inhospitable to life, but they're really cool. Because they all have orbits of 3.3 to 4.9 days. Their temperature is 2,200 to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Ouch.
And they all orbit hotter and larger stars than our own sun. So here are the bullet points. They found a planet with a density of styrofoam, which is kind of awesome. I wonder what it would be like to live on that planet.
It would be annoyingly squeaky.
Really? It'd also be very hot, so you'd probably not be able to hear it squeaking. But They also found two planets whose, well, I guess this makes sense, surfaces that are hotter than molten lava, right, the temperatures I just gave. And then they also found two planet-sized objects, they're calling them, because they're the size of planets, but they're actually hotter than the stars around which they orbit. So it's kind of confusing. They're kind of trying to analyze the data and figure out what the heck these things are, because we've never seen this before. These planet-sized objects that are hotter than the stars that they orbit. I mean, imagine that. So,
well, thanks.
Anyway,
thanks,
who knows
Ben.
What's going on with that?
Thank you, Ben, for the story.
Cool,
yeah, very cool. All right, Al, let's talk a little bit about an element. You pick it.
Okay.
You pick any element we'll talk about.
Let's talk about something that we all kind of know about, but we don't really know about. I ran across something recently, and I thought it's just the type of thing our listeners might like. It's something that I'll bring up here. For example, if I asked you to tell me about your cell phone battery, what would you say?
Lithium ion.
Yes, you would say that. But a lot of people might say it's small, light, and lasts a long time. And that's good. But like Lyle and a lot of the people, especially listening to us right now, they'd say, it's, well, it's a lithium-ion battery.
But so, my first iPhone in the 80s wasn't lithium-ion.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So then lithium is sort of important in that mix. Obviously, they call it lithium-ion. So what's lithium and how does it work and where does it come from? Well, I'm going to just go over quickly what a lithium battery is, what's inside a high-powered lithium battery. In its metallic form, lithium is silvery and it's the lightest of all metals. One of the biggest problems with lithium, though, is that it's highly corrosive and it can catch fire spontaneously. So when it's in the science lab, when people are experimenting with it, it has to be stored under oil to prevent this violent oxidation, which creates the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The first commercial lithium-ion battery was released by Sony in 1991, and that pretty much revolutionized mobile consumer electronics.
Yeah.
So lithium-ion batteries are basically filled with pressurized lithium salt, and that's dissolved in an organic solvent. Usually ether. And it's got two electrodes and a separator sandwiched between them. When part of a circuit, lithium ions move from the negative electrode made from carbon, which would be the anode, to a positive electrode, the cathode, made from lithium cobalt oxide, freeing electrons which then travel around the circuit so as to create power.
Uh-huh.
The batteries are recharged by applying power to the battery, and this forces the ions to move back into the negative electrode, and so the process can start all over again so you can recharge
and basically,
these things.
What you see inside is lithium moving from one to the other depending on which way the electricity is flowing.
Right.
And it deposits on the cathode or the anode depending on if you're charging or not.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's very efficient. The lithium batteries are light. They've got a low self-discharge rate, about 5% a month. And they're way more powerful than comparable batteries using other types of chemical.
Wait, 5% a month. So that means, so if you charge a lithium-ion battery and you just store it, after a month it's going to lose 5%. That's pretty good.
I know. It's great. I mean, that's a problem with rechargeable batteries is you recharge them, you don't use them for a while, and then they're dead again.
Right. And then you leave it in the charger forever, which I don't think is very good for them anyway.
Right. Which lithium is efficient there. So it's really good for that kind of thing. And you can also make it in all different kinds of shapes and sizes. And then you can strap them together. The battery packs in electric cars, for example, have multiple batteries strapped together. Lithium-ion batteries have a long shelf life. Eventually, they stop holding their charge. But they are most lithium combinations are toxic, and they need to be recycled. So now we know kind of what lithium, its involvement in this whole thing. But then you think about, I know it's in mobile phones, iPods, Blackberries, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's relatively new because before lithium came along, we used nickel-based batteries. One of the earliest commercial cell phones was the Mobira Senator, launched by Nokia in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a small handset, and it was connected to a nickel-based battery pack. And the whole thing weighed...
I'm going to go with 5 pounds.
22 pounds. What's your cell phone weigh now?
As small as the same weight as my 3-year-old.
Yeah,
two-year-old.
Your cell phone's it's not 22 pounds. It's a lot lighter.
Right.
So since this is such a great thing, between 2003, 2007, the battery industry doubled its consumption of lithium carbonate, which is the most common ingredient in lithium-based products.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of rounds out, you know, sort of how we're using it for gadgets and things like that. But what about other uses? You know, the other use, obviously, is we're going, hey, you know, the oil industry, we're all aware the oil industry has created a lot of problems, not only politically, but also for the environment and all that. So we go electric, all right?
Yeah.
So
well, that's been a big push, right? Because then you can recharge with maybe solar energy or wind energy.
Exactly.
Or hydrogen, right?
So the energy part of it's fine. But then, you know, how are we going to store this energy in the car? So what we're going to do is we're going to get lithium, right? We're going to put lithium
just
batteries
like
in there.
Just like Miles recently did with his Prius. Miles, didn't you buy a new lithium pack for your Prius?
I believe it is lithium, but I'm not sure.
How expensive was it?
Too expensive.
Well, currently, most electric cars are using nickel metal hydride batteries.
Okay. Yeah.
But the performance isn't quite that good. But everybody's moving to lithium. The new Chevy Volt that's coming out in 2010... Well, this is 2010. It's going to have a lithium battery. The Mercedes is going to have an S-Class.
And, of course, the real reason for this is they charge fast. All these reasons you suggested, they charge fast.
Yep.
So they last, the power lasts for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's light, which, of course, for a car is a major importance.
Right. One of the reasons why it wasn't adopted for so long was they were trying to make sure that it could pass crash safety standards.
Because of the corrosive nature of lithium. Yeah.
Well, lithium, like, for example, the laptop batteries.
Yeah.
Those lithium-ion batteries that we always heard about, you know, catching fire periodically. That they are not just a chemical fire.
Yeah.
And they're not just, you know, a standard heat fire. And they're not just, like, there are multiple types of fire. So you need a fire extinguisher that handles four different types of fire.
Right.
Not just, you can't just pour water on it. Pouring water on it would make it worse.
And in some sense, it's fine for a laptop or a cell phone to catch fire because, you know, you just make sure it's not in an environment where it's going to burn other things. You're fine. It doesn't work so well like an
airplane as we go across the country.
That's not so good, but there's a lot of people to help.
Well, you know, they're having this. Lithium's going to be in everything. It's in the Tesla. So... Now we're moving on to electric cars. Where are we getting this lithium?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it's a mineral, so you got to mine it.
Right.
So it's going to be in the ground most likely.
Well, currently, mining companies are out there now dying to find lithium.
It's expensive. It's a good
everywhere.
Resource, right.
The largest deposit at the moment is in Chile. All right?
It's
like 3 million tons, they estimate it at. But there's a new player on the scene, Bolivia.
Oh.
Bolivia is in South America.
It's all in South America, yeah.
Sort of a lot of history there. They're estimating there's 5.4 million tons of lithium in Bolivia under their salt flats. And in some estimates are even saying up to 9 million tons. And this is the U.S. Geological Survey saying this.
Huh.
So we're talking Bolivia is massive, has a massive amount of lithium.
So,
and it's kind of underneath lithium is kind of like this salty kind of stuff. And if you think of like a big dried up lake, like, you know, salt flats and stuff, where you drill under that and there's like this slurry and they're able to go in there and suck that slurry, salty, briny stuff up.
Right.
And then they can separate the lithium out of it. And then that's how they get the lithium.
Lithium, by the way, in a metal form is about half the density of water. So if you took lithium and you threw it in water, it would float, even though it's a metal.
Mm-hmm.
It would also explode. It would burn quickly.
For the moment that you saw it before it exploded.
which is worrisome, though, because like think of what happened with the Middle East when oil was discovered.
It's like, exactly
yes,
my point.
Yes, there was a lot of wealth went there, but there was also a lot of disparity and a lot of other unintended consequences.
Right. I mean, are we creating a new oil industry now?
Right.
Except it consists of lithium, and it's going to be, you know, here we have a developing country that is finding this massive amount of wealth. Is history going to repeat itself? Are we going to make the same dunderheaded mistakes we made with oil? Because there's a lot less lithium than there was oil, and we're using it in a lot more things.
Okay, except just to argue against this, and so that we don't sound too pessimistic.
Right.
Lithium is renewable in almost every sense that as soon as you pull it out of the ground,
it's an element.
It's not going to go anywhere. It's not like we're burning it and then it goes in the atmosphere.
Right.
It's not the same situation as fossil fuels in the sense that once you have it, you're going to use it and keep using it like gold.
But lithium plants, when you're refining and like,
yeah.
does produce a fair amount of sulfur dioxide.
It's
difficult to create, and then how we have to really think about how we're recycling these things, because if these things end up in our landfills, I mean, it's really important that we recycle lithium batteries, because otherwise we end up with this this resource that we're using up. It's toxic once you know it's sitting in a landfill. I mean, it can be it can be extracted and recycling, and isn't real easy either. But it's like we're coming out with more and more of these portable gadgets.
And I just wanted to say that your analogy to fossil fuels, of course, is apropos, because this seems like an energy flow, but it's not an energy source. It's an energy transmission medium. And the rarity of it, it's much more like silver and gold. And, of course, we've destroyed environments for that as well.
Mining in general
is pretty horrible.
Mining is like, and Bolivia is very, their government is saying, hey, you're not coming in here and you're not going to do the same thing you did to us or you did to the Arabs.
In Bolivia, of course, this is a giant resource for them.
Right.
And the question is how they manage it, and it's a sensitive subject.
You have a big shift of power that I see in the future, and it might be because of this new thing that we're using in practically everything.
And we'll keep using it. Now, of course, we do talk about every once in a while other battery technologies like carbon nanotube battery technology, and something might emerge, but it could be 10 to 12 years out, and by that time, some serious stuff could happen with lithium.
It'd be great to see people focusing more on batteries.
I agree.
And then coming out with a new, you know...
So we're really far behind today.
Okay, well,
but
I just had
it was
to
great.
That,
sorry, so. Thank you so much. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. Let's see. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by the University of Advancing Technology, offering a master's degree program for geeks to become innovators of the future. Class is now forming for January, which is now as well. UAT.edu/masters. Check a look. You're listening to GeekSpeak on KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam and Al Lucka. And over the phone, we have Mr. Ben Jaffe. We are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. You're welcome to ask us anything you'd like today. Anything you'd like, you think we might be able to answer in an honest way or something like that. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. And that's in the 831 area code. Or you can call us at 1-800-655-5877. And of course, that's a toll-free number, 1-800-655-5877. Rick Fellman is waiting to take your call and pipe into the airwaves. Anybody have an exciting podcast they've been listening to this week? A new thing? Nothing? Nada? Ben, please.
Well, the podcast that I found was the Environ Minute, which is a little one-minute sections about segments about environmental news, the problems, and potential solutions. So,
Environ
nice.
Minute.
And then, that's a pretty good one.
All right, thank you very much for that.
My news, indeed, is Star Trek news. But first, I just want to introduce. So the Queen has knighted a number of different actors. Sir Peter Jackson, I think he directed Lord of the Rings, right? Sir Ian McKellen, who was in Lord of the Rings. Sir Elton John, you can go on and on. Now geeks can rejoice because we now have Sir Patrick Stewart. And of all the people in Star Trek to be knighted and bestowed that honor, I think Patrick Stewart is the one. It just rolls off the tongue, too. He's done Shakespeare, so.
Well, he's also one of the only members of the cast that was actually British.
That might have something to do with it.
You don't knight people who aren't British, right?
I don't think so.
Or are part of the Commonwealth, at least?
I'm sorry. What?
That's right. Yeah, you don't knight them. You don't knight people that aren't British citizens. But there is something you can call them.
Yeah.
If they're not British citizens, the Queen can still give a title of some sort. I just can't recall what it is.
But they're not allowed to joust.
No jousting.
Okay. Jousting's only actual knights can.
Only
joust.
Available for the Atari 2600. All right. Let's go ahead and take a call from Scotts Valley. That's always a fun thing to do. Rafael.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Hi. Have you heard about the new Toshiba battery for cars? They just came out with a car battery, I think it's lithium ion, that lasts 10 years and it takes 5,000 recharge.
For a car battery. Yeah. Oh, I see. So you replace your lead acid battery with a lithium battery.
Well, no, it's for electric cars. So
I
think it will power an electric car, won't it?
Well, saying stuff like it lasts for 10 years and it takes this many charges. Oh, I guess what they're saying is this is how many charges it would redo, would allow to recharge.
The equivalent to 10 years is what they're saying.
Right.
I just read a brief article about it.
It's very cool. Yeah, that's the kind of batteries you're talking about that will kind of revolution, like the volt will run on them. And it's basically going to make electric cars functional. I wonder if this is the year of electric cars.
I believe it is. I've been into it since I was like 8 years old, and I've been saving articles ever since. Anything I could, I've got piles of boxes with stuff on electric cars, and I want to build myself an electric limousine or get one. They already have them, of course, in Japan, and they build them in Italy. But I'm gonna. That's my main objective right now is to.
Cool.
It's amazing how many people are like into green, these electric cars and stuff like that, and they always have been,
Yeah.
why haven't they been on the market? And they haven't been on the market because batteries just
aren't
as good as
it's all in the battery, and it's a really important part of whether. I mean, the technology of an electric car is not that groundbreaking.
No.
It's the battery.
Well, in fairness, it's not just the battery. Like, for example, the reason their cell phone lasts a week, like if you don't have a smartphone, that your cell phone lasts for a week is not just the battery. Even though battery technology has increased, it's because the electronics are pulling so much less power per unit.
Absolutely. In fact, the wheels on the electric limousine out of Japan are generator. They generate regen. But they're also the power. There's eight wheels, and the power goes into the wheels, which I think is way more advanced than Tesla, say, that uses drivelines and that kind of thing, where you're actually using gears.
Are you talking about the wheels themselves are motors?
Yeah, so they're wheel motors, and they're also brakes and generators.
Right.
Probably limits their top speed, though.
It might,
top speed is 247 miles an hour.
Or it may not.
And that's check it out, do
Google on electric limousine. And then there's an Elicta, too, also. And they're really weird looking, but they're super fast. And at 45 miles an hour, it goes 247 miles.
Thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
I think those Toshiba batteries go 1,000 cycles. That's what it says.
Hmm.
What I'm seeing.
That's only 1,000 days. Well, no, actually, they last a little longer, but yeah.
I don't know how they determine a cycle.
Right.
Totally. No, my Prius battery lasted, 9 years? So.
Yeah, that's not bad. That's about 1,000. No.
Yeah, it just can't be quick charged.
Right. Which the lithium can to some degree. All right, well, let's go ahead and try to take a very hard radio question from Marty in Santa Cruz. Marty, what's up?
I want you to try and explain the relationships between the different screen resolutions that we're faced with on our computers and our TVs.
Okay, go ahead. Explain that, would you?
he wants us to explain it.
Oh, man. It is a tough topic to talk about. So specifically, you want to know about, like, what's your resolution of your TV screen?
Well, that, but especially when we're trying to, say, use the same screen for computing and television, both HD and standard.
Well, we can give you some simple answers, but they are simplistic.
When you see a TV saying it's a 1080p, that means 1,080 pixels vertical.
Right. So there's 1,080 pixels of lines across the screen going from left to right, stacked on top of each other. And then the translation of that, you can assume to some degree, is a 16:9 ratio. So that it's if it's 9 high,
it's
then it's 16
TV,
wide.
Yeah.
Right. And this then gets more and more complicated because everybody does it slightly differently. And then that standard of how many, 1080p has to do with not exactly how many pixels, but much more about whether the legal requirements are met to say that you're HD 1080p. And then say 720p is, again, like that. When you don't see the P on there, it just means that every other line is drawn every time.
So it would be I, like 1080i.
Right,
so
interlaced.
Yeah, right. So
does that kind of answer your question, or do you have more questions about that?
Well, how would this relate to, let's say, the different resolutions we can pick with our video card and our computer?
Well, if your computer... Miles, do you want to talk?
Well, with regard to a video card, if you're looking at resolutions, a 1080p monitor would be something along the lines of 1,900 pixels wide. So across, there would be 1,900 little dots, and then 1,080 pixel little dots going from top to bottom. And together they form a grid. And that's the number of pixels that you have available on your screen. And then to find pixels per inch, for example, you'd basically look at all of those pixels, find the size of your screen, and that's how many pixels there are per inch.
But to make it even more complicated, that's not a standard size for a monitor either on Windows or Mac.
Right,
I mean, they go like 1280 by 960, 1152 by 870, 1024 by 768.
Right, but those are the 4x3 resolutions.
Right. But those are typical sizes. I mean, as far as when you look at your computer, you're going to see those kind of ratios.
Right.
So there was never a big meeting where everybody got together and said, let's all do it this way.
There's a lot of meetings like that. It's just you never really get get that everybody needs a slightly different thing, and therefore you don't really get a standard.
And then you have different pixel shapes too, which I deal with a lot.
The pixel shape is that not everybody has a pixel that's square. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're rectangular, and or effectively rectangular. Really, they're circular, but they fill a space that's rectangular.
And there are some that work on a hexagonal model, so they're not.
So then you send a logo to your client, and then they put it in their video, and it started out as a circle, and then when they see it on the video, it's an oval. And they say, what happened to our logo?
So when you've got a widescreen like the 720p, and you've got a 16:9 ratio, meaning that your screen is 16 times versus 9 times high, that percentage, then if you've got a 720 vertical slices, then your horizontal resolution horizontal, then your vertical, left for right, you have 1280. So 1,280 from left to right. And so then, multiply those two together, 1,280 to 720, and really quick, that's like 900 million, something like that. In any case, that's how many pixels there actually are. And so that's not a standard of like the new Mac, the newest MacBook Pros. The resolution, they're not a 16:9, right? So they have a 7. Mm-hmm. That's what you're talking about. Yeah. The ratio is not really right.
And so he was saying, Marty, do you have a slide rule handy by any chance?
Because you might need the slide rule. And then the dots per inch thing is such a complicated thing for people to understand. Right. We used to always talk about we have to upload this kind of picture size, make sure it's 600 dpi, dots per inch. And then that doesn't really mean what you really care about is how much data you have. That's how I was trying to explain to people. Whether I've got an image that's 600 dpi or 72 dpi has no bearing on what the image is. What's important is how many pixels there are. And so if I display it in a 600 dpi environment, it will be one size. And if I display it in a 72 dpi environment, it'll be a different size. And then that gets really complicated with a screen because your screen is never actually 72 dots per inch. It's depending on the resolution you set it at. And it's also depending on the physical quality of the screen. It's really
It depends on the resolution and the physical size of the screen. You could have something that was 72 dots per inch.
I want to know, though, if the geeks did like a live show in Santa Cruz somewhere, maybe Watsonville somewhere, maybe Monterey, I don't know. We go to a format, we do a live show, and during the show, or after the show, we do like a explanation of resolution for an hour and a half with video and try to get people to learn that. Are people interested in that kind of thing? Do you want us to see us live in person? I mean, I got to say that I've got a beautiful face for radio. And Miles actually is pretty good looking. if you're interested in that, let us know. Send us an email. Tell us that you would love to do that kind of thing.
Because it's confusing.
It's confusing.
It's a confusing thing. You
but
almost
it's
need
not
graphics.
You, can explain, you need graphics. You can't explain it on air. It's really difficult to explain. Right. So there you go. Did we answer your question?
Well, you certainly gave it a good shot. And I think we're still a little baffled about what happens when you start mixing your computer and your TV watching on one screen, but I think that is
baffling. And I gotta say, I wouldn't say I'm baffled in any way about it, but it is hard to explain.
Right, and that's not altogether by accident either.
That's right.
Because there are a lot of media publishers that don't want you to make your computer as a TV. They want the TV to be the TV and the computer to be the computer and never the twain shall meet.
And here's the biggest thing to remember about any presentation of, audio or video. If you look at it and you hear it and you think it sounds and looks good, then you don't have a problem, right? If you then have a friend that comes over and goes, and you're like, just, experience the evening, maybe add wine to the evening, and then when they leave, enjoy your TV and your experience again. Because there's no absolute, this is the right way on this stuff. It's really about how you experience
things. It's not binary. It's like my dad always said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
That's right.
Well, there are a lot of folks that swear by Blu-ray or high-definition video, and I'm actually satisfied with DVDs. If you have them side by side, I can tell the difference.
Yeah, I can tell the difference.
But when I'm watching a movie, I don't care.
Really? Right. Okay, there you go.
I honestly don't.
Thank you, Marty, for the call.
I'm going to get a whole bunch of hate mail for that one, too.
You probably will. Yeah. Thanks, Marty, for the call.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. And I'm serious. If you're interested in doing having a Geek Alive event, all we need is people interested, and we'll do it. It's fun to do, and we can definitely do a resolution show. It's just that we need graphics, and you want to help make graphics for that, Al?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the subject.
You know a little bit about it?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. From Aromas, Sam, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hello, welcome to Geek Speak, Sam.
Hey, I have an Acer laptop that unfortunately had Vista on it. And it apparently developed some kind of a virus or whatever. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it actually belongs to my son. And we got it from Best Buy, and they gave us two discs that they cut, say, replacement disc A or whatever it is, disc A and one and two.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, I put those discs in, and it says that it's 65% done. And do I need to actually put the original Vista discs in?
You need additional? No, you need to, when you bought your machine, and the disc that came with it should be enough for a full recovery of your system. They should have the OEM software on the discs. Miles, don't you agree that that's?
Yes, that's usually the case. Just make sure you have a backup before you use them, because they will bring your system back to the state that your system was when you first bought it. So all of your data that you would have had on it is gone.
Right. That's right. It's kind of like a reset button, you know, in a game.
I accept that the data's gone because I don't want it to be there anymore.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
Well, then perfect. Yeah, you just follow the steps of a total recovery, and they'll erase the hard drive and reinstall the OS from these disks.
It'll be a while.
Yeah, if you can't recover your system with that disk, then you need to call Acer and make sure that you get it, because that should have come with your – did you buy it new?
Yeah.
Yeah, you should have all the materials you have necessary
to wipe it and bring it back.
Okay, so there's these other disks that were put together and by Best Buy that say one and two on them. What are they?
Those are they.
Okay.
They are them.
Them are they. Them are those? Those are them? All right, thank you. Those are them. That's it. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we've gotten a light call load today, so let's go do some more news. And if you want to call and try to get in the show at the last minute, please feel free to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Mr. Miles Elon.
All of this talk about lithium and the limited resource and going to different places for it reminds me of another story that I have, which is that we have a need for many rare materials, such as neodymium, which is one of the 17 metals critical to green technology. For example, it's
neodymium.
Yeah.
Neodymium?
Yeah.
Neodymium?
Yep.
It's fun to say, neodymium.
Yeah, I like that.
And it's used in motors, loudspeakers, other appliances. It's also a rare earth element. So it's, you know, motors, we absolutely need those. You need them for wind turbines.
Sony doesn't need them for tape anymore.
Nope.
But there's something that is constantly in use, and yet it's a rare element. They're only located in certain places.
Yeah.
In this case, and with 16 other rare metals that are commonly used with green technology, they're located by and large in China.
Mm-hmm.
And China doesn't necessarily want to get rid of them.
You think
China might want to use them for themselves, or at least get a good
population.
Deal, like have the manufacturing base in China, not ship it out as a raw material. And so, for example, with neodymium, they produce 97% of the world supply.
Wow.
It's not like, oh, we'll just go someplace else.
Can you shoot through those and tell me what are rare? What stuff is
the,
rare?
The list of metals, I don't have them.
Not even metals. Right away. So other stuff like heliums, we're running low on helium as well.
Yes, although helium is a whole other issue. Like, for example, when you're mining in Texas, I know that we have huge
and all those miners helium. Have to hold those balloons. It's
humiliating
so hard.
Too, actually.
Well,
and you're
all
pink.
Time.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
And you got these guys all dirty and grubby, and they've got these balloons they're carrying around. And,
yeah, as you know, and as we've covered on the show before, helium for a long time was just vented out into the atmosphere. We didn't care. As we were mining, it was just a byproduct. It was just something in the way. And then someone went, oh, hey, I'll just, you know, bottle it up and sell it for parties, you know, to blow up balloons. But in fact,
is that how it worked? I love that. Hey, wait a second. My kid would love this stuff. Go on.
Well, among other things. But as it turns out, helium, you know, it's one of the elements in the periodic table. It's not something that you can just, you know, recollect.
It's very hard to create elements.
And helium has a nasty tendency to just escape from the ground and just leave our atmosphere and just head out. So if we lose it,
We don't
get it back. We'd have to go, you know, mine the moon or, you know, mine something, you know, someplace else outside in space.
So you're saying is that China's got a lot of these metals that are rare. And it sounds like South America has a lot of lithium.
Many of them are crucial to any type of green revolution that that people have been talking about in the news.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Elam, for that. Ben, you got a closing word or two for the day?
goodbye? No, I don't.
Okay. Good said.
Coming up in just a second is one of Al's wonderful crazy USB of the week. And I just want to mention that the show here, Geek Speak, on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue, online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. The geeks today are Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. My name's Lyle Troxell. And we also have, of course, Al Luckow. And Al Luckow sometimes, most of the time, does these wonderful, crazy USB of the weeks.
Hi, Al.
Hello, ladies. Welcome to my cubicle.
Wow, you're looking pretty smooth today with your leather jacket and all. Is there something in your hair?
Oh, my hair. I see you are admiring how cool I look.
Well, your hair does look sort of slicked back.
It's probably because of my new USB device.
You have a greasy USB device?
No, no. It's an IMM Barber 2GB USB flash drive with a comb built right in. Check it out.
So, you saw us coming, pulled out your USB device, and combed your hair really quick?
You betcha.
What's that message on your computer monitor?
What? You mean this? Let's see. Warning, the disk was not ejected properly. Always eject the disk before pulling it out. You may have damaged your data.
See you around, Daddy-O.
Yes, folks, this is a real device. The link is up on geekspeak.org. Feel free to gawk at it there.
I shouldn't be surprised at this point, I guess, huh?
I just have one thing to say.
Yeah.
Neodymium.
Neodymium. Does this comb have you neodymium?
Neodymium.
This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. To find out more information about today's show and all the things we talked about at geekspeak.org. Every week we put up tons of fun information, and of course, all week long you can ask us questions there. Just send us email from the website or participate on our forums. Till next week. See ya.